Hey guys, this is Nikhil.
And this is Nick.
And welcome back to Informatonauts.
Coming at you at the end of a, let's be honest, it's a rather long week. So we apologize to keep you guys in suspense and waiting with bated breath, but hopefully we'll make it up for you today.
I think it's been more of a long week for you than it has for me. This week has flown by for me.
Oh man, yeah, it's been long for me. I've been a little bit under the weather and just kind of scrambling between some different projects and things, so I'm definitely very tired and ready for the week to be done. So looking forward to this weekend. Got any big plans coming up this weekend, Nikhil?
No, just working. I have a lot of code to write and a lot of things to get done and a lot of papers to publish. So just lots and lots of work.
Yeah. So for me, it's Holy Week this week. So we have Good Friday service today. There's a great vigil service tomorrow evening, and then Sunday morning with our Easter, having a brunch and that kind of stuff. So it'll be a full week, but I'm looking forward to today afternoon service and then in the evening just kind of being on my own and digging away on a few side projects and some different things. Tomorrow's event's just going to be in the morning, an easy morning, and then I'm going to spend the day catching up on a bunch of reading that I've been needed to do for a paper I'm working on. And then we have in the evening, it's called the Great Vigil service, which is awesome. Until I moved to Seattle and started going to an Anglican church, I didn't know what this was, but it's Good Friday. They actually will seal the doors of the sanctuary with like this big clay seal that they like strap over the front. And then to celebrate the Lord's resurrection on Easter Sunday, on Saturday night, the priest takes this big old sledgehammer and there's like a phrase that he says, something like, "Let the Lord arise," or something.
"This is Sparta!"
Something like that, right? And then smashes the seal open with this sledgehammer. And then we go into the sanctuary.
So. Crazy.
And it's like we light like a big bonfire out front ahead of time and like we go in with torches. It's kind of awesome.
You know, I really miss Easter egg hunts. As a kid. I wish that I could do it as an adult and not be that weird guy doing an Easter egg hunt.
I know. We need to find families with children that we can like attach ourselves to so that we can go and do this type of stuff. I'll call it Robinson Palooza right now. So at my parents' house, my cousin, one of her friends are in town. Her parents are coming into town. My dad's other brothers, like there's probably 30 people like in the Fort Wayne vicinity where my parents are.
Wow.
Visiting, and they're doing a big whole thing. And then on Sunday we traditionally do an Easter egg hunt with like 200 or 300 eggs. And all over my uncle and his and aunt have a lot of property, big woods and stuff. So we go and hide it all over there.
Well, maybe you can stick some Easter eggs in your coat to celebrate.
There you go. I could definitely do that. So. Anyway, so that's what this weekend holds in store for me. So.
Well, cool. You know, I go out to brunch every Saturday and Sunday.
You love brunch. You're a brunch machine.
I've eaten at probably every brunch place available in Seattle. Like, if you want to know about a brunch place, just name it and ask me my opinion. I'll tell you exactly what the food's like.
What's your favorite brunch place in Seattle?
Oh, man. My favorite is called The Dish.
Yes.
Out in Ballard. But a close second is Tallulah's.
Tallulah's, okay.
Yeah, out in Cap Hill. Oh, man. Like, the food is just ridiculous. It's amazing. Their eggs, it's cooked, well-cooked, but also moist. Like, it's not runny either. It's, like, it's really good. They have amazing scrambled eggs, and the portions are just perfect. So if the dish was not so homey and I wasn't so attached to it, I'd be eating at Tallulah's all day, every day.
That's awesome. Now, how about one of my favorites is The Yard. Partially because it's only 5 blocks from my house.
So mm-hmm.
One of my favorites, but we've had
also,
that
also a good place.
Yeah. So I like that. Remember we were there the last time and the lady was, we were taking our order and getting the juice and she was like, "Oh, well, we have some of this grapefruit juice back there that we're not serving, but we got some of these grapefruits in." Mm-hmm. I was like, "Oh, that sounds amazing. I want some." And so she brought me a cup of grapefruit juice. So that was very nice. They like squeezed themselves or whatever. So.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, so we're doing an Easter brunch on Sunday, which I'm looking forward to. So.
Cool. Yeah, I was just thinking, like, you know, all the places are going to be just full of people this Sunday.
Yeah, it's going to be packed.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah. Very good. All right. Well, what do we got on the schedule today, sir? What do we want to talk about?
Well, you asked me to go through this flu paper, which yes. I kept sort of avoiding doing for a long time, but I finally went through it. And if you want to chat about that,
I do.
I'm game.
I do. So this paper was really – I saw it a couple weeks ago, and it was really fascinating to me, and I didn't understand it. So, yeah. So I'm excited for you to tell me what it actually means. It's more your area.
Sure. Well, I mean, I guess the gist is that a lot of flu models were basically overfit to the available flu data that we have. So this person, this researcher, he actually sort of took information out and made a more generalizable model. And in doing that, it was actually able to get a more accurate model, and a model that was right more often than the overfit one, which makes sense, mm-hmm. right? And that is basically the 10-second spiel of what that paper is about.
Okay. Now, what did they do? So this paper, to give a little background, I saw it on – came up on Ars Technica a couple weeks ago talking about a new method for predicting the flu. I think it was was it published in Nature?
It was published in Nature.
Yeah. So – what's the approach that they did differently? Because weren't they trying to link it back to more like the underlying physiological systems and stuff?
Yeah, I think this model in particular, what they were trying to do is basically predict the evolution of the flu. So they were using H3N2, and they wanted to see how it would change over time. And they had mutation sites that would bind to antibodies, mutation sites that would not bind to antibodies. And you know, frequencies of how often certain clades showed up in different samples and things like that. But I think they basically, I don't know for sure if they use this method, but maybe something like PCA to figure out which was the most impactful.
What's PCA?
PCA is something called, it's called principal component analysis. It's okay. When you basically look at so imagine a data set with like 100 columns, and each column is a dimension.
Yep.
You're going to have a few of those columns are going to have a much bigger impact than the rest, and they're going to have like bigger variance and things like that. So if you wanted to plot, if you wanted to reduce that down from 100 dimensions to 2 dimensions, you would use PCA.
Okay.
And that's – so you can kind of just take the most important factors and kind of say the rest is not as relevant as we think.
Okay.
And I think that may have been how they got from A to B. But again, the Ars Technica article here does not have that information in the article, and I haven't pulled up the Nature paper myself, so okay. I can't tell you for sure.
All right. Now, based on your visualizing of this, or you're going through this, do you think that this is something that's unique enough and that might have a good chance of being useful?
I think it's going to be good for the next few months, years, flu seasons. But the thing with models is that, you know how that saying goes? I think it was George Box who said, all models are wrong, but some are useful. Exactly. And the thing with models is that they have to be updated every so often. And I think this was one of those times where when they updated the model, it was just time to, you know, it just ended up being that it was a perfect time to do that.
Okay.
So, yeah. But I think a lot of times statisticians, bioinformaticians, researchers in general just kind of end up having this innovator's dilemma of they just don't want to throw out the stuff that they've done and start afresh because they feel like they're losing a lot. But really, if they did start fresh, they could approach their design differently. They could approach everything with more wisdom. And they might be able to do it better, but they're afraid to do that. Yeah. So, yeah.
Interesting. Now, you used a phrase right there, the innovator's dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with you in the library when you got that book.
Yeah.
What is this? Give us a 30-second spiel on the innovator's dilemma.
Well, it's basically like I just said. It's when a researcher or a company – this book was in the context of companies
mm-hmm.
– when they are afraid to throw out their old technology because they're afraid, you know, it's like their moneymaker, and they're afraid to keep moving forward and pressing onward and furthering their design because they are afraid that if they give up what they have, they're going to lose their business. And ironically, that sort of by keeping their old technology, they become stale, and that puts them out of business anyway. So it's a matter of being progressive in your change, and at least controlling your change that you're changing in the right direction.
Interesting.
Cool. Yeah.
Have you started the book? Or are you?
I've started the first few chapters. You know, whenever I read a book like that, I don't actually read every single word.
Yes. You wiggle your way through it.
I do. Yeah, I pick up the stuff that's important, and the rest I just kind of flip through.
Interesting. Yeah, that's not the way that I read books.
That's how I go through books so quickly, man. I go through a whole bunch of them.
Like, but there's so much. How do you know what is useful and what's not? Because, like, the books will build, especially good books, will build a treatise from the beginning to the end. They, like, walk you through everything.
Well, a storybook. I mean, there's one book I'm reading right now called Uncharted, talking about, like, viewing human culture through the lens of big data.
Mm-hmm.
And that one's written more like a storybook, so I can't really skip chapters in that. But I think a well-structured book is going to have a good table of contents. Uh-huh. And a good index. So you'll be able to kind of crack open that, the chapter that seems interesting to you. And that chapter should theoretically be a standalone chapter. And then you can do the exact same thing with other chapters. So I kind of, when I read a book, I don't read it linearly. I kind of bounce from chapter to chapter, reading the stuff that I find interesting.
See, most of the books that I read are, you know, it's like reading a paper. So you go from the background to the application, to addressing, you know, concerns and problems, and then, you know, finish off, right? So you're working through. You need that foundational idea.
Is that how you read a paper though? Because I tend to go to the abstract and I figure out like the motivation and the outcome.
Yeah.
And then I go straight to the conclusion, and then the discussion, and then I go back into the background and then the methods.
Let's see. So I read papers. It depends on the type of paper, but yeah, I tend to read more. I tend to read things more linearly and walk through as stuff unfolds.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I'm going through, I'm in my mind making a list of questions or concerns, or I'm highlighting things on the paper. And then as those get addressed, then I'm, you know, coming back to them. So I do tend to read things more linearly. Obviously, start with the abstract. That's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can, you know, sometimes I'll be like, this paper is not going to be relevant or useful to me, then toss it. But I find that there's so much interesting information and useful knowledge that is encapsulated in the stuff that's built around the central thesis. So when you take something piecemeal, you miss that sort of holistic, either the mindset and the process, thought process of the author, or you miss all of the information and the interesting tidbits that go along with building an idea and an argument. And so that's why I tend to read things more linearly. Now, if I'm working like a technical, like a programming book or like a more technical book, then yeah, you pull out the section that you need and I flip back. I grab stuff is, okay, it's like, oh, I don't recognize this formula or this concept. So flip back to where that was elucidated. But
this might be why I can't read fiction. I can't, like, I have to read every word, and that really, I'm kind of impatient. Like, I feel like I can read fast, but at the same time, I can't read as fast as I want to read.
Yes.
You know, it's like if I get a 100-page book, I want to be done in an hour, and I'm not going to be done in an hour, especially if I, you know, want to retain any information I read.
Yeah.
And that frustrates me. It annoys me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that is that tension that is a tension that you have to walk in when you're reading books and when you're going through material like that. But I think, so for me, as I, you know, I'll sit down and read fiction or read literature. And literature especially, so there's fiction, like today's modern fiction, I can churn through a 300-page book in, you know, a day or two. But then you give me a 300-page, you know, work from an older author. Like, there's a density and there's a weight in there that is it, that page number just is a really poor substitute for.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I was getting frustrated with reading some of these books, I was like, oh, I just want to be done. And then I realized, well, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to read the book to have read the book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not actually reading the book to go through the journey with the characters, to allow the story to unfold, to put myself in that reality. And that's a travesty. And then I've lost the essence of what it is to read a book and to sit witness with the author and the story that's unfolding. And so I think but that's common with a lot of people, that we just don't think about that anymore.
You know, I had a similar thought, and this is going to make me sound a little like superficial. But my mom is an English lit professor and she's read a lot of the great classics.
Yeah.
And I haven't, and yeah, I just don't have the patience to. So what I ended up doing was going to Wikipedia and sort of reading all the summaries of those books. And not just, I mean, Wikipedia is pretty comprehensive. It has a lot of Like you said, I'm not going to be going along for the journey that the author is taking me on, but I'm going to get the point of the book. I'm going to get the morals. I'm going to get the characters. I'm going to get the ideas around it. I'm going to get, you know, how famous the book is and why it's important to our culture. And that's pretty much all I need to have a good conversation about that book. And it's not, I mean, I readily admit that I haven't read that book, but I do know about it. So it's like, it's one of those situations where I can, if somebody talks to me about a book like that, I can make conversation, but I can't like go into detail and talk about my experience reading that book.
That's, that burns in my soul. That's just
efficiency, my friend. Efficiency.
But comes with the loss of something. So when you read Tolstoy, I love Tolstoy. Anna Karenina is one of my all time favorite books, and I love War and Peace. They're both just amazing. And, as you're reading Anna Karenina, you're reading along, and all of a sudden, you'll just read a phrase, and you'll just, like, you'll set to stop, and you get this sort of, like, this feeling in your chest, and you're just like, how did he know? Mm-hmm. That you read something that grips you, and Tolstoy has a terrifying grasp on humanity, that he just understands people better than anybody else. And when he writes something, he'll be writing in, you know, the mid-1800s or the, 1870 something. And he's like, that happened yesterday to me. Like, I was in that situation. I felt that emotion. And I didn't even realize it at the time. Like, so for me, I am much more logically and factual driven. So, and I have a difficult time sometimes expressing emotions. And reading Tolstoy has helped me learn to express emotions because he writes it in a language that I understand. I get Russian literature. Mm-hmm. Like it makes, like I can wrap my mind around it. And when you just read the summary and the story, you miss all of that. When I read Anna Karenina, I read my brothers and I have walked that story together. And when I read about the oldest brother, Alexei, I can't remember. Sorry, I'm blanking on his name. Like, I walked that journey with that character because that's the character that I identify with, even though he's a pompous jerk. Like, that's the character that I know. And you miss that when you read a summary. And there's a part in there where Anna is talking to her the protagonist, the female character is talking to her husband, and she calls him you. And there's a little asterisk. She says you are, or something like this. And there's a little asterisk, and you flip down to the bottom, and it says, Tolstoy switched languages here, and he wrote, or no, it says it in the text that he says, and she used the French form of you to avoid the terrifyingly intimate Russian you, because that was the turning point in that book when her marriage was over, and it was simplified by the French word you.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's all stuff.
He flips back and forth between these languages, like, because all of his characters, they all speak Russian and French, and some of them speak English, but English is the barbaric language, so they speak English kind of ironically, like mm-hmm. as a joke, which is really funny. And that sense, and that's what you get out of great literature, because great literature is not just it's not just the facts and the characters. It's not just the morals, because you have to walk that, right? When you read, like, Brothers Karamazov, right, you walk through, and the brother Dmitri is the spirit of, is Russia. He is the spirit of Russia that is personified. And as you walk and you feel, as you're like furious at him, and you're like, how could somebody think and understand this way? And then he becomes this really ennobled character, and you get this pattern that emerges that you journey through, and it's that pattern and that pacing and that meter that elucidates more about that story than anything else.
Yeah, I definitely agree that those are details that I definitely missed when I read a summary. But at the same time, I think it's still okay to read a summary. And the reason why, I think it has to do with kind of my background and like how I was raised. So on my mom's side, there are a lot of artists on her side of the family. Artists being like sculptors, writers, painters. We have like almost pretty much all of them. They're either artists or politicians, one or the other. So the thing is, with art, I felt like a lot of those relatives that I've had who are artists, they basically have a message that they're trying to convey through their art. And the medium is almost irrelevant because the message is what's important. And yes, a certain medium, like maybe a certain message is better communicated through painting, or mm-hmm. a certain message is better communicated through writing, or through sculpting, or whatever medium you choose to use. But at the end of the day, the artist wants you to grasp that message. They want mm-hmm. you to grasp that moral, that value, or see things from a certain point of view. It's kind of, it's engineered, believe it or not. Like you have to like think about it before you actually write it. And it's, you know, there is that, I do see people, I have met artists who are also less like, let's just make things happen and see what we get. And they want it to be spontaneous. And if it's spontaneous, it's sort of like this act of God or something like that. But at the same time, most of the artists that I know, and a lot of the successful artists I know, they actually think about what they want to communicate. And then they find the best medium to do that in. Mm-hmm. And then they execute on that. Which is a lot like, you know, coding or working on a business. You know, you have a vision, and then you make that vision happen.
Yeah.
So I think assuming that a book has a message like that, and that the summary encapsulates that message, then I'm getting the major 80% of that book, and yes, I'm missing the 20% of those emotions that you feel when you read a book, and that is. Definitely a high price to pay, but in terms of like actually understanding or getting the message that the author is trying to convey, mm-hmm. I think I still get that.
I can hear that. The one issue that I quibble with a little bit is the fact when you say that when you use the phrase details, mm-hmm. as in the way that those are the things in between major themes, right? Which yep. I would argue with. I think that the details are what draws it, but draws it out. And engaging with a lot of artists that I know, when you ask them to describe a piece or to point out things in the piece, oftentimes they'll point out something that's very small and seemingly insignificant, but that carries a huge weight to it. And that,
matters
a lot. And so, I'm mostly joshing you, for being a Philistine. But
I think a good metaphor, or maybe an apt metaphor, would be that if you imagine a painting, a blank canvas is like a blank painting, right? It's just like you start from scratch. Yeah. But then when you draw the lines on there, like the outlines of what you're going to be showing as figures and you're painting like people, you outline your people or you outline your landscape. I'm just seeing the outlines, whereas you're seeing the outlines and the vivid colors.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm missing all those colors. It's like being colorblind, but I'm still seeing what the landscape is.
Right.
So, yeah, there's a lot of beauty that I'm missing and a lot of interesting things that could happen with color because it can make a break. It can give a painting a very different feeling, mm-hmm. right? But I still know what that painting is.
All right. Fair enough.
Yeah. It's a very stripped down way. But if you want to get through, you know, a buttload of classics and not really understand any of them, this is the best way to do it.
There you go. I would, though, encourage you to the discipline of reading is something that process is extremely valuable as well. So I would encourage you to put a book on a list and try and go through it. I've got a couple that are really phenomenal that you would love,
mm-hmm.
and that you would enjoy reading, but then the process would, they're books that require you to sit and work your way through them, the payoff is you would just love it. So the one that comes to mind is Dune by Frank Herbert.
I have not read Dune.
That is one of the greatest science fiction books of all time. It is a tremendous piece of literature, absolutely brilliant. And that is the one. It's long. There's a lot going on in it, but it doesn't bog down. You read it, you move through the story.
Really?
Uh-huh. So that would be one that I would recommend. You'll absolutely love it. It's so brilliant.
I will add that to my list of things to read then, and hopefully I'll get around to reading it.
Yeah. So now, you had something pulled up over there.
Yeah, you reminded me of, we're talking about reading quickly, and I remember seeing this app called Spritz. I think it was on Lifehacker and on Ours and a bunch of different places. And basically what they do is when you speed read, the idea is that the fact that you have to move your eyes from word to word slows down your reading.
Yep.
And if you're able to kind of keep your eyes stationary and the words can rotate under that same position quickly, you can basically take in a lot more information than you otherwise would be able to. So they claim that you can get your reading speed up to like 500 or 600 words per minute.
Yeah. Wow.
And of course, you know, it's going to be different. You can't do that with technical things. but with things like a storybook or things that are read linearly, I think it's probably an interesting option.
Yeah, this one was interesting to me. So I've looked at a lot of speed. I don't speed read. I do now when I read books. There are many. Sometimes I will skim small sections. Mm-hmm. If I've picked up the gist of it, I'll kind of like move to the. So I do like a little bit of selective small skimming. Mm-hmm. Usually just a paragraph at most, but. This one, but there's a lot of people that do speed reading techniques, and I don't do that because I just have never taken the time. It seems kind of funky to me. But this spritz thing was interesting because it was not, let's figure out how to cut out information to make you move faster, mm-hmm. but let's look at the way that we actually read a book and realize that, again, we spend 80% of our time just moving and refocusing our eye. So spritz is basically this, like, circle that you look at, and they just flash they flash the words through it at a high rate. And so the idea is that you just focus there and you see the word and your brain is more than fast enough to process each word as it comes through. Mm-hmm. And then you can kind of, you know, you don't have to move your eye and you just zip right through the actual word content of what you're reading, which is interesting to me. That's an interesting approach. And it's one that I want to try out and see how it works. The one thing that I am curious about is, how would that do with the rhythm and the meter of the words that are written on the page? So, for instance, so I have a copy of Seamus Heaney's translation of Beowulf, mm-hmm. and Seamus Heaney is a poet, a Nobel laureate in poetry, taught at Harvard and Trinity and all this stuff. And one of the book is really, the lines are broken up into not only concepts, but also to be read aloud. He rewrote it in the oral tradition. He wrote it in the way that his family speaks, which he calls them big mouth scullions, which is kind of an awesome phrase. And so my concern is that, and again, spritz is probably not appropriate for all medium like you were talking about, but the concern that I think truly great authors write rhythm and meter and flow into the book, that your mind kind of like jumps and stutters and moves through. So some lines read so quickly that others are really broken up and you have to like stop and think about each word and each thought. And so I wonder how spritz would hold that integrity together. I'm not saying that it wouldn't. It may be that our minds process it fine as they go along. But and then some word, I think like poetry is broken up into lines. The meter is to be this thought, this thought, this thought, this thought.
Well, that might be a good iteration on this app. Maybe if there is a algorithmic way to figure out exactly how to meter your reading, but still kind of scale it so that way it's quick.
Yeah.
That might be different. You know, like a little pause between paragraphs or something. Yeah. That may help mitigate that loss, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I still think that's the price you pay for speed. You know, it's like in bioinformatics when you align a genome. You're always, if you want a fast alignment, you're going to be sacrificing accuracy. Yeah. If you want an accurate alignment, you're going to be sacrificing speed. And it's a balancing act between the two.
Yeah.
So I think that carries over here.
Yeah. And I think this could be, I'd be really excited to see this. You know, there's lots of content that I consume on the web that I'm interested in just kind of like pulling out the information, read an Economist article or something off Salon or whatever. And so something like this where I could go through it really quickly and just process it would be kind of cool. So I am definitely looking forward to them releasing a test app, and I definitely want to try it out and see if I can use it. I did their little like demo thing on their website, and mm-hmm. it is different. It's not all that. It's a lot more natural than I thought it would be. Mm-hmm. I was able to read it and go through, and it's odd to not move your eye, but it's it was actually kind of cool. And yes, I'm excited to see what they do with this technology. So. Well, enough about books. How about we move back before we go on back to biology?
Sure.
All right. So I saw this article the other day, and I just had to talk about it on the show. Mm-hmm. So this is off the New Scientist. This is from last week, 10 days ago. And it is titled DNA Nanobots Deliver Drugs in Living Cockroaches. So basically, what they did was they found out that if they inject small strands of DNA, that when it interacts with a certain protein, it'll unravel and bind with that specific molecule and mm-hmm. then start interacting with it, and the genome can be uptake and all that stuff. And so basically what they were saying is that they have
they have the ability to really start programming life forms. And, like, especially with these cockroaches, they're able to, like, by stacking up sequences of these DNA strands, they're able to start directly interacting and flow controlling, basically, with these molecules and these cells inside the cockroach's body. And they were saying that they've got it now where they're able to scale it up to turn a cockroach into, to turn it into the equivalent of a Commodore 64.
That's, by using, I'm in awe.
By using, like, synthetic computing. This paper was in Nature Nanotechnology.
Is it by Andrew Hessel? Or who is the author here?
Levar at Daniel Levner at Harvard. And then Bar-Ilan University in Israel.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I used to work in that space, or I've at least dabbled in it. And it's really, really complicated. You start to realize that we have no idea how the how any kind of body works, even bacteria. There's a lot of stuff that we think would work but doesn't work, and a lot of things that we expect to not work, but somehow it does. So we don't quite understand the system, but we somehow are able to figure out that, you know, the system being the black box, you know, if we input X, we get Y, but for some reason, if we input X and we don't understand what the box is doing and we get Y, it's still okay. So there's like this, I mean, one of the biggest issues that I had was this philosophical debate of how can we program something we don't understand? Imagine using a language where you, like a computer language, where you program something and it, you know, you expect it to work and it doesn't. But then you do something very different that you expect to not work and it gives you the answer that you want. And you're just like, okay, this is magic. Don't touch it. Let's just let it be. Because we get the answer we want, and then let's move on to the next part of code. That's basically the way that field is working right now.
Wow. Yeah, that is really interesting. That brings up a lot of ethical and philosophical questions of, you know, the simple answer, pat answer is like, oh, playing God or whatever. But we can sidestep that. there is a lot of saying, like, we're doing something, and we're getting the results. In a sense, This is like the quintessential big data era, like, scientific approach of we get an answer, we don't know how we got that answer or what the underlying mechanisms are, but we got an answer, so we're going to go with it.
I think the hope is that over time we'll collect enough data that we can actually make a model and perhaps start to understand what's going on, but biology is not that simple. I think there's going to be a lot of other breakthroughs that are going to inform and really help bolster synthetic biology up. It's kind of like a low profile field right now, but I bet you it's going to start blowing up in the next 10 to 20 years when we have breakthroughs in biology, like more breakthroughs, and we can actually model things accurately. All of a sudden, we're going to have biofuels. We're going to have like an army of bugs.
Yeah.
Like you just pointed out over here.
Yeah. Well, they're talking about, you know, the ability here of being able to do extremely specific like cancer targeting and drug delivery, in that you just fire in a bunch of molecules with, you know, these DNA sequences and stuff, and then you just it is what is a computer? A computer is controlling the flow of electricity through a device, and that's all you're doing. You're flow controlling by activating and deactivating certain operons and interacting with certain cells and binding to different proteins, and you're just flow controlling through the life form. And so you've taken an application from computer science and you've transferred it across domains, which I think is absolutely mind-blowing. I love it when we do stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And now we can start interacting with this high-powered computing within life, like physical life forms and stuff. It's just kind of mind-blowing.
Well, I think we might be able to push, you know how we kind of, when we got Boolean logic, we kind of pushed forward computing,
because
we could do a lot of computations that we couldn't do before. And I think synthetic biology, once we get biological circuits working, that's going to take us to the next level of logic, I'm hoping, which is going to make our reasoning a lot more interesting.
Yeah, that is, that definitely.
And if it's any message as to how important or big synthetic biology is going to be, Craig Venter, the guy who helped decode the human genome, his institute, they've shifted gears and they're working completely on synthetic biology right now.
Wow.
That's all they're working on as far as I understand. I mean, I read about this like years ago, but as far as I, you know, things haven't changed that much. So
no, that's kind of awesome. It is definitely going to be a really interesting emerging field.
And he's written two books too. He's written one called A Life Decoded and one more called Life at the Speed of Light. And I think maybe if you set up like a Google alert for synthetic bio, you might be able to watch all these kind of stream in real time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is an interesting field that has so much potential, but does also have there's a lot that we need to be wary of. If there's a lot of things that we don't understand, and a lot of questions of not only can we but should we that need to be asked reflectively and critically. And so I'm looking forward to the dialogue and the interaction as we go forward. But the potential for the alleviation of so much harm, and to the potential for improving people's quality of life and health and everything, is just tremendous. Absolutely. So. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of life, I've got another paper that I've been meaning to get to that I've been wanting to talk about for a couple months now. And I saw this on MIT Technology Review, and I thought we had to bring this up. So this is from a couple weeks ago. It is a couple months ago, I guess now. April 15, 2013, and I saw it just a month or two ago on MIT Technology. That came up on ours, I think. It was called Moore's Law and the Origin of Life. So this is a group. This is really interesting because, especially the. Let me see if I can pull the paper, because it's the people who are on, who the co-authors on this paper. Let me see if I can find it here. I think it's over here. So it's a couple folks who are not the people that you would normally consider to be there we go. Okay. So sorry about that. All right, here it is. So it's by a couple guys. One is at the National Institute of Aging, and the other one is at the Gulf Specimen Marine Biology Lab in Panacea, Florida. So basically what these guys did is that they said, hey, we know that Moore's Law applies to computer circuits. Does it also apply to biological complexity, in that there's a doubling effect of the complexity of life? There's a doubling effect of the complexity of life that we can kind of extrapolate backwards on. Mm-hmm. And so they looked at it and said, oh, yeah, there is. So we can go from mammals, kind of fish, worms, eukaryotes, prokaryotes, and kind of extrapolate back. And that it roughly holds true that life doubles in complexity every set period of time. And so they said, increased exponentially, doubled every 376 million years.
Mm-hmm.
So they said,
and complexity is like D and the amount of DNA.
Genome complexity.
Okay.
Increased exponentially, doubled every 376 million years. Such a relation reminds us of the exponential increase of computer complexity known as Moore's Law. By the doubling time in the evolution of computers is much, but the doubling time of computers is much shorter than that in evolution of life. Cool. So they said, okay, so we know that the age of the Earth is 4.5 billion years. So what happens if we extrapolate back to where we get genetic complexity reaching zero? And they said that time would arrive at 9.7 billion years ago,
mm-hmm.
which is 5 billion.
The Earth is only 4.5 billion years,
right? Which is 5 billion years older than the earliest estimated age of the Earth.
Hmm.
So then the question becomes, what happens? Like, how do we get there?
Oh, well, that's interesting.
Yeah, and so the paper is in preprint. I need to go back and see. I found this on the preprint sites, but I need to go see if it's actually gotten published. But they don't really have a lot of answers. So they pointed out, what if the early steps of the origin of life created complexity much more quickly than evolution does now, which would allow the time scale to be squeezed into the lifespan of the Earth? And this is a reading off of the Technology Review. It says, Shirov and Gordon reject this argument, saying that it is suspiciously similar to arguments that squeeze the origin of life into the time span outlined in the biblical book of Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
So then, did life originate from somewhere else? Kind of like, have you heard the idea of panspermia?
I have.
Right, yeah. So is this like a panspermic idea, or like, what is it? And so it's really a thought-provoking provoking piece, and they don't really offer any like a lot of really good conclusions to explain it. And obviously, it's a simplistic model, but it does raise some interesting questions of.
I know, but I feel like it's misapplied. Like we just talked about how all models are wrong, but some are useful.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Moore's law, I mean, that's useful in terms of describing computing, and people kind of tend to use it as like a rough benchmark because we kind of know how it works. But to take it like in this context and that seriously, I feel like it's a bit of a stretch.
I think one of the issues that this paper has is that it assumes that we can fit a curve to complexity and go backwards, and that we continue to arrive at functional units.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you would have to say that, like, there at the beginning of time, there had to have been a rapid increase in complexity. Otherwise, because it's not like you have, like, one, like they said, going back to, like, one base pair or, like, zero complexity. Like, that one base pair is useless, right?
Yep.
There had to have been. And we talk about it. I think it's Stephen Meyer that does the punctuated equilibrium, which is like, why haven't we seen over the course of human history, why have we seen life be basically the same, right? And it's that life like evolves in these fits and starts, and that we're just in we're at an equilibrium right now. But then the next phase, it's like punctuated, and all of a sudden we jump to this next level of complexity kind of thing. And I think you would have to say that something like that happened at the beginning of the universe. Otherwise, because you just can't, like, you just going from one, there's what is the onus to go from one base pair to two base pairs to 10 base pairs, right?
Well, environment, because it's natural selection, isn't it? Because, I mean, you might observe punctuated equilibrium,
mm-hmm.
but that's not a cause. It's more of like, if you have one organism, and one has two base pairs, and then one has one base pair, just as, you know, a rough, dumb example. And then for some reason, the one with two base pairs, it fares better in the environment. That's going to reproduce, and it's going to end up being high in quantity. So when we observe stuff, especially over time, we're going to see that, hey, look, we had one base pair be prevalent, and now, you know, 100 years later, two base pairs are prevalent. And that's a punctuated equilibrium. It fits into that theory.
Mm-hmm.
But really, if you kind of sort of tune in the power of your microscope a bit higher, we'll see that it was actually more of a gradual change. This is what we see in, like, Hardy-Weinberg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
It's more of, like, gene flow and base
pair. Yeah, I think, well, in punctuated equilibrium, the way that it's – this has been a long time since I looked at this, but the way that it's applied is sort of like phenotypic evolution, like things that we observe, right?
Yes.
So all of a sudden life is different. And when we look at a lot of the life, like life forms on Earth right now, they seem to have arrived like kind of roughly the same like time span. Like it's not like beavers have been around for millions of years, but rabbits are only like 50,000 years old, right? It's like these things kind of like they jump together. And of course there's a lot of genetic complexity and variation, microvariation that's going on through it, but that it's in a sense there's a reason why we don't see just this like gradual evolution, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh my gosh, now this is like humans 2.0. it's like this fits and starts kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I argue a little bit with the I question the idea that life would just, that complexity just sort of like grows, and that it seems to be that you can't just extrapolate back and say, well, something should have been at one complexity. I think there had to have been some sort of like initiate.
And this is, I mean, already it's wrong here. I can see that eukaryotes are way lower on the list than mammals. I mean, if you look at just genomic complexity, I think plants and bacteria are much more complex than humans.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, plants, they can have like four chromosomes each. We only have two in terms of genomic complexity. I just don't see how you can argue that humans are more complex than like sorghum.
We stick to the measure of genetic complexity by the length of functional and non-redundant DNA sequences rather than by total DNA length, which is a paper, which is Adami and Shirov papers that they cite.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things about plant genomes, is that a lot of plant genomes are highly repetitive, but then again, so are human beings. So maybe that's why they said mammals, not humans, because for some reason, like, we have a lot of repetitive sequences in our genome, and we don't know what they do, and we can't explain why They exist there, and we haven't really been able to function or to characterize them because our technology doesn't really allow for it. Like next-gen sequencing and even the old vector-based methods, like we just can't reconstruct a genome even after we get the data because computationally we just can't, can't do it.
Interesting.
In fact, that's how Google Books are able to, like that's how they can actually get away with scanning a book, uploading it, and not having the copyright people come after them because they actually take away a few of the critical link points. So that way you can't really piece that book back together and print it out yourself. Like you have no idea what page
comes for what. No, I remember reading about that. Yeah, that was kind of fascinating. So, yeah. Anyway, so thought-provoking. This paper, I'm sure, is going to – I think it's got a good chance of getting published simply because – well, simply because it's a very provocative argument. And I think that a lot of people are going to have some interesting arguments about it. But and it's building on – and when I'm looking at the citations, it's building on a bunch of other papers that have been – published before, so they're kind of they're building a theme and an idea here. So.
Are they doing the whole salami thing? The whole salami publication.
What is a salami publication?
Like they're publishing the minimal publishable unit.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of Shirav here. It's got a lot of papers here. Oh, this is interesting. There's a 5 Wikipedia citations.
They couldn't just go to Wikipedia and, like, find the real citations inside Wikipedia?
I guess not, so. No, I don't know. Anyway, so that's interesting. All right. Cool. So I definitely wanted to get to that. That was one that I've been
aching to get to, yeah.
Yes, so I'm glad that we talked about it a little bit. And I think you are exemplifying the reception that it's going to get from the rest of the scientific community.
What? Just
uproar.
What?
So, trying to not be offensive and be like, you're wrong, but at the same time, you know, it's hard, you know, we do try to be objective, but at the same time, we have a lot of prior knowledge or even beliefs, and they kind of really affect our lens. And that can be a problem. So we try to be objective. You know, even if I don't think that it's right, I do try and keep an open mind.
Yeah. Like,
okay, well, it could be right. And I look for ways to make it right. But at the same time, I also look for ways to make it wrong. And that's what you do in science. You basically you make a hypothesis, you try and disprove it, not prove it, but disprove it. And if you can't disprove it, then it must be true.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Great.
Interesting. Very good. Did you want to talk about this make your own comics thing?
You know, I put that in there. I don't – it was not recent. I think I put that in there months and months ago, but we can crack it open and just see what's inside there.
Yeah, maybe. So tell me about this because I remember – so this show is a very housekeeping show. We're catching up on all the things that we've been trying to get to for a really long time. And
I think Make-Believe Comics just allows you to make your own comic strips. They just give you a bunch of little comic book – characters and little props, and you can just drag and drop them into your own little comic strip with your own little text bubbles, and you can make your own comic. So if you can't find something on XKCD that you think is appropriate to your presentation, then maybe you can make your own strip.
There you go. Although, let's be honest, is there anything that's not on XKCD?
I don't know. And more often than not, like any kind of issue that I have, I can exemplify with XKCD.
Yeah. Now, have you seen this website, XKCD Sucks?
I have not.
They bet it's basically a website, a vitriolic and bitter collection of unwarranted nastiness about a silly and harmless comic. And it's literally this website where they take each comic and they rate it, right? So this one is sitting here, comic 1345, which is, let's see, we can pull up XKCD.com. 1345, which is one about answers. It says, humans are defined by our curiosity, our hunger to ask, our hunger for answers. So then the friend says, we all spend a third of our lives lying down with our eyes closed and nobody knows why.
Touche.
Touche. Right? And so the rating on this was R-minus, and it just says, I'll bet Randall says touche in real life. Okay. All
right. I wonder who
runs this blog?
I don't know. My friend posted this on Facebook. He just said, this seems like an unnecessarily nasty thing to have on the internet. Like, yes, it kind of does. 62 comments. Let's see what the comments say. The first one goes, what a bizarre and ridiculous ad hominem attack. No, this is, oh my gosh, this is just ridiculous. Tragedy of the commons. Yep, there you go. Oh my. So, anyways, so if nothing's on XKCD, then you can go and find it on Make Your Own Comic. So, but I do love me some XKCD. I think it's awesome.
I haven't read XKCD in quite a while.
I don't sit there and read it, but I see it referenced enough that I feel like I've seen most of the ones that are.
Have you ever read Cyanide and Happiness? Have you heard of that comic?
No.
It's I actually have a whole like slew of web comics that I read whenever I get time. Cyanide and Happiness is pretty funny. There's also something called Depressed Alien. If you've heard of Depressed Alien, it's also really good.
Yes, I have. Uh-huh.
So those are just a handful of the stuff that I read.
Yeah. So speaking of nasty and vitriolic kind of stuff, I found this article on the New Republic called, it's titled, I've Discovered the Internet's Most Internet Sentence, and You're an Idiot If You Disagree, with your as in Y-O-U-R.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, that is the world's most internet sentence. You're an idiot.
Like Y-O-U-R?
Yes.
Instead of Y-O-U apostrophe R-E?
Yes. And he goes through and he talks about how that is the most internet sentence in history, and he's kind of right. That really does capture the essence of the internet.
So, okay, I'm speechless. I have no idea what to say.
I know. Just like, I'm going to put this in the notes. You can go and you can read it because it's pretty awesome. But.
Does Tolstoy have a line for this? Like, if he was here today, could he summarize my emotional experience? It's just like...
At a loss for words?
Yeah. Well, no, but like, you know, I want to say it's kind of hard to articulate. It's kind of like despair that the state of the internet is that shitty, but at the same time it's like funny.
No, but you could go with Nietzsche, right? So you could go the madman.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and he tossed his lamp upon the ground and gazed at them with his eyes that pierced, and then he stepped back and he said, for I am not yet, I'm too early, my time is not yet come. Or you go T.S. Eliot, and this is how the world ends, not with a bang but with a meme.
He said that?
No. T.S. Eliot says...
I was like, what?
No, T.S. Eliot says, this is how the world ends, not with a bang, but with a whisper.
Mm-hmm.
Or a whimper, something like that.
This is how the internet ends, with a meme.
Yeah. Hollow Men.
Yeah. Here's a funny Cyanide and Happiness strip. So there's a cop holding a gun against, or up to a person in a gray shirt, and says, you're under arrest. Anything you say can and will be held against you. And the guy in the gray shirt says, your body. And then the cop goes, oh, no. And the guy is, like, rubbed up against the cop. So it's just, like, I think it's more of a play on words, Cyanide and Happiness. They just kind of take things that you say, and then they kind of have an alternative interpretation of it, basically. Yeah. So
very good. All right. Well, this is starting to devolve into people listening to Nikhil and Nick surfing the internet. So go check out the New Republic article, the internet's most internet sentence. And if you can come up with a clever and awesome Tolstoy reference to the despair and the fall of mankind, then that would be one. You could also go to the Arcade Fire from Rococo. They build it up just to burn it back down.
This is slaying me. I just ran a bunch of code, and it's about, a lot of it is about 95 to 98% done. And then I just got a Java heap space out of memory error, and
that
it all crashed.
That is just fury in my bones. I feel the rage that billows up inside of me.
It's been running for 18 hours, Nick.
I know. And you're just like, and you know what? If you do your like dash D xmem ops and then give it like 25 gig, it will run out of space again. Because why can't the heap just dynamically reallocate space? Like,
why can't they give big data students like big space to work with?
Dude, just spin up an EC2 instance.
I'm not going to pay for an
EC2 instance. 3 cents an hour.
But then I have to load all my data and stuff.
I know, it's a pain.
You know what? We're still on the air here. So maybe we should... I've already forgotten that we're still on the air.
That's okay. Guys. No, we're talking about Java. This is podcastable, right? Everybody hates Java. So Although my project next week is I'm learning Scala.
Okay, Scala is what, the Lispy Java?
Yeah, it's like a functional language. So it's supposed to be not super terrible, but so next week we can talk about my adventures into Scala.
Oh, please do. Yeah, I would love to hear about that. All right. And also about your frustrations.
Oh, I'm sure it's gonna be awesome. So. All right, folks. Well, I think that's the end here. We're gonna let you go, and apologies for just kind of like it kind of fell apart there at the end. But
yeah, rambling.
Yeah.
Well, either way, you can contact me at Nikhil Gopal on Twitter.
And I'm at Nick Robinson.
And of course, you can catch both of us at Informatonauts. And thank you guys for listening. Yep. Have a great brunch on Sunday.
Yep, brunch it out bro style. We'll see you guys next week.